hope life is treating you right wherever you are in the world. I'm in Los Angeles. I just got back from Asia. I've had a nice week decompressing in the wonderful golden California sunshine. I did a really cool show with Bill Burr and Al Madrigal last night, and it was a part of the All Things Comedy Network secret show. It was awesome. It's cool to be a part of that network. It's like the Justice League of comedian podcasts. And I'm in Los Angeles now. I want to give a shout out to Jonathan. He's Canadian. He lives in Seoul, Korea. He sent me a really nice email. He was going to come to my show, but he broke his ankle playing softball. That's what you get for being a Canadian playing softball, I guess. And he couldn't go to my show in Seoul, Korea a few weeks ago. Gave his ticket to his friend who came to the show and loved it. And now he's a fan and he's listening to the podcast. Very nice serendipity to happen. Jonathan asked me if I could recommend a book that I love. And I'm glad you say that because it's summer and I always try and read one epic book every summer, which this reminds me I haven't chosen anything yet. But Shantaram by Gregory David Roberts. I read this book about 5 years ago. It's almost 1,000 pages long. The opening of the book is incredible. He says, I never knew freedom until I never knew what freedom meant until I was hanging upside down in an Indian prison being beaten on the feet with a club. It's a hell of a book. This guy, apparently it's a true story. He was an English literature major, becomes a heroin addict in Australia, does petty crimes, gets sent to prison, escapes, somehow ends up in India, and he's in Mumbai, living in the slums, being a slum doctor from his Boy Scout medical training. Then he starts working for the mafia in Mumbai. All this stuff happens to this guy. He gets thrown in Indian prison again. He goes to Afghanistan. While they're having war with the Russians. It's a hell of a book, and it's almost 1,000 pages. Somebody should make a movie of it. Maybe not. They would ruin it. Because East of Eden, the John Steinbeck book, that's 400 pages. And the movie East of Eden is only the first 150 pages. So I guess it would be like that. There's no way you could encompass the majesty and brilliance of this book, Shantaram. So that's my book recommendation for the summer. Gregory David Roberts, Shantaram. So today's guest is Jason John Whitehead. I met this guy in Sydney, Australia. We did shows together in Jakarta and Asia. He's from Nova Scotia, Canada, but he cut his teeth as a comedian in London for many years. Now he's spending a lot of time in Los Angeles. He still performs all over the world. He's a great friend of mine. We sat down on this gorgeous sunny day today and had this conversation. This conversation is less than an hour old, and it is my pleasure to present to you now the one and only Jason John Whitehead.
Good evening. How are you, Comedy Store? Good on you for coming out and taking on the cold weather. I'm from Eastern Canada. Some of you might have been interested to know. Good evening. And I'm about little Eastern Canadian white trash. I drive a 1993 Ford Escort. That's right, I'm worth it, you know. You can judge me if you want, you know, but I could drive a nicer car if I chose to. I make tens of pounds doing this job. Tens of pounds, man. I do, man. I love my Ford Escort, though. It doesn't get me any speeding tickets. It doesn't, but it gives me the illusion of speed. It's like the Millennium Falcon, man. You feel like you're going fast when you're in my car because everything's rattling around inside it. I'll have somebody in the passenger seat who's going, holy shit, Jay, the doors are coming off. Yeah, that's because we're going 23 miles an hour, motherfucker. Gonna have you in London in 2 hours. From somewhere just outside of London. That I didn't bother to memorize. because I drink a lot. And I realized a long time ago the joke works. Anyway. Somebody walked up to me the other day and went, "You're a comedian. That just means you want to be famous, right? Comedians just want to be famous." It's a ridiculous question. It's annoying. It misses out the whole point. The art form. To say, "Oh, comedians just want to be famous," that's like saying, "Ooh, pedophiles, they just want to get on a register." You missed the whole crux. What's up?
Jason John Whitehead, ladies and gentlemen. Jason John Whitehead.
Yeehaw!
Now, why not just Jason Whitehead or John Whitehead?
I went to school with a Jason Whitman, and he was a tall, good-looking guy, actually, so I had a bit of a complex. So he was always the Jason W in school, and I was still like this little skinny, weedy 14-year-old.
So you went with a double name thing to differentiate yourself in high school.
Well, no, it didn't happen until after high school when I started in comedy. I really wanted to do the double name just to have my own thing. You know, there's another sneaky thing that happens, too. When you go on the listings in Britain, it helped to have the double-barreled name because you stuck out in the listings.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So when you used to scan through the Time Out magazine or whatever to see where the comics were on, I always noticed that a Jason John Whitehead took up that extra little bit more space and it was more noticeable.
It worked. I remember seeing your name before I ever met you. It stuck in my head. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's cool that that worked. Now I'm here in the States and I'm going by JJ Whitehead. Because...
Well, we like abbreviations here.
Yeah, you like abbreviations.
It comes from our hip-hop culture.
And all the American comics, they love...
In Los Angeles, they call me XLT.
Oh, yeah? XLTR. I noticed that there's a lot of American comics who are really quick to screw up your name.
Yeah.
So as you're traveling around...
Well, like, oh my God, that's happened forever.
They'll talk to you before the gig. They're like, "Oh, it's Jason John Whitehead." I'm like, yeah. And then they go, "Welcome, James Whitehead." And so that's when I just came to the realization of, okay, so America's going to have to be JJ Whitehead just to simplify things for everybody so that they can't screw it up easily.
It's good. And how do you like Los Angeles?
I'm loving it so far. I mean, the weather's a nice treat.
Yeah.
You know, from Britain. I was just in Britain in January and spent the whole month in the rain. And the whole time I was thinking, I can't wait to start this little LA adventure because I knew it's going to be sunny.
I was in England for 2 weeks in February and it was ass-biting.
Still
cold.
Shit, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah, it's horrendous.
But now you're from Nova Scotia, Canada. So let's paint a little background here. What you started in Nova Scotia?
No, I started in Scotland
as a comedian.
Yeah, I did my first open spot at the Stand Comedy Club in '98, I was just new to Scotland.
Wow,
I'd been there for a couple weeks. I grew up in a military family. But I was working in South Carolina. I was working at Marriott hotels and vacation clubs.
Wow.
Yeah, running their activities, like doing dolphin trips and the golf tournament and volleyball.
So your family's in the Canadian military.
Yeah.
So it
exists.
A lot of times, just having picnics and cookouts and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, hey, we're going to marshmallow again tonight, troops.
that's how tough it is, man. My father's a navigator. So, and my father was actually the commander of the Shearwater Air Force Base during 9/11. So,
wow.
Yeah, with that, so he took on a lot of those planes and stuff. They got redirected, and that was a big moment in his career. Only time he's ever had to be armed on his own airport, you know, with orders that he can shoot if he has to. You know, they had to clear all the planes.
Where? Nova Scotia?
In Shearwater, yeah. If you look it up, a lot of the redirected flights on 9/11... they all got sent up to Nova Scotia, and so Shearwater Air Force Base.
And wasn't Nova Scotia where they rescued the Titanic survivors?
Yeah, yeah.
That's Nova Scotia's claim to fame.
Yeah, that's the...
And then the first wire communications transatlantic.
You got it, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like the first telegraph or something.
Yeah, and Alexander Graham Bell's place up in Cape Breton in northern Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
That's where he lived, and yeah. Yeah, that's what we're known for. And that's what the Canadian military actually does in Eastern Canada. So we're a lot of sea patrols, you know. They're out there. between Newfoundland and Iceland, you know, there's a lot of space. So right. That's all Canadian. That's what our military does. So
how did you end up in Scotland?
I was burning out in South Carolina. I wasn't enjoying the job. I was literally...
All that Hootie and the Blowfish and, over and over.
Yeah, Dave Matthews Band. There's only so many times I want to listen to Crash.
Oh my God, Kenny Chestnut again.
Where I was like, I got to get out of here. And I wanted to find something more. Weirdly enough, I thought it was a job that I was always going to want. Kind of wanted to work in hotels and stuff. And I thought I could travel the world working for hotels and... But after my first like 8 or 9 months down in South Carolina, I just realized it's not for me. It's still too many rules. Still had to be clean shaven with a tie, you know. Even when you're out in a boat showing people dolphins, you're the one there in the tie. And I remember looking over at other like dolphin tours and stuff and seeing like the hippie guys who are the independent ones. And I just remember thinking, okay, there's a better way to do this. And so I just wanted to go on a little adventure. So I packed my bags. I asked my military dad, I said, where's the nicest place you've ever been to in Europe? And he said, Edinburgh. Go to Edinburgh.
Oh, wow.
He said, it's beautiful there. So that was my decision. So I slapped down all the money I had and...
Moved to Edinburgh.
Took off to Edinburgh. You know, got that... When you're young Canadians, you can get a 2-year visa to work in Britain. So got that visa, went over to Edinburgh, and then on my second night in Edinburgh, that's when I wandered into a comedy club, and you know, and I was just with, it wasn't with friends, you know, I was with people who I had just met at the backpacking hostel or whatever, so there's nothing to lose,
right.
And I remember cool. the compere said, does anybody want to give this a shot? And I just remember thinking, you know what, I'm gonna do that while I'm here, and so I signed up for their open mic and started doing it a couple weeks later.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and then a few months later, I had some friends come over from Canada to join me, and we were supposed to go backpacking around Europe together. That was the whole plan. I was going to cash in my chips from Scotland, and then we were going to go hit Holland and, you know, travel around. And I remember being so into stand-up when they showed up in Scotland. I told them, I said, you guys go ahead without me. I'm going to stay here for a bit. I've got a 5-minute spot next week. I'm staying for that. And yeah, I was hooked.
Cool. And then from a few years there, then you moved down to London?
Yeah, then went to London after 2 years because that's where it's at, right? So
right.
You can get on stage every night in London in 2000. So
well, and you guys don't have that work permit issue. Like, I know it's difficult for people to just work in the States and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Canadians and Australian people can go to England.
Yeah, totally. Especially when you're young. I think it's under 26, I think, you can get the 2-year visa. It gets harder as you get older, I believe.
Hmm.
But yeah, I imagine you can get a different kind of visa or something. But yeah, that youth visa or whatever, that's it's pretty
good. But there's a plethora of great Canadian comedians living in London.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Phil Nichol and Glenn Wool was there.
Yeah.
And
a lot of them have... a lot of them do have visas, but in the case of people like Phil Nichol, and I think Woolley as well, I think they've got European passports. You know, because you only have to have one parent or one grandparent. You know, I now have an Irish passport because I have a grandmother who was born in Ireland.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So there's the Canadian connection. You can get these passports, and like Phil Nichol as well. And that way you're a European resident.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's how a lot of us are able to... stay and work and skip the lines at customs.
So how many years were you in London for? And
well, then, okay, so then I was in London probably from 2000 to 2003. But in 2003, me and two Australian comedians, Jim Jefferies and Steve Hughes, the three of us were tired of London and we felt that we weren't moving forward with our careers. And there was a comedy store in Manchester, so we decided to bite the bullet. The three of us moved to Manchester together. And we lived in Manchester from about 2004 until 2008, I would say, 7 or 8.
Hmm.
And it was great for our careers. We became regulars at the Manchester Comedy Store. They opened a comedy store in Leeds as well at that time. So they had a lot of special, like there was a Men at Work night on a Wednesday night where you go and you make fun of the news and stuff. So all of a sudden we're working every Wednesday and we're working weekends at either club. So it really picked up for us. And then around 2007, 2008, we all moved back to London, you know, because it was time to go back to to the Big Smoke.
Why was Manchester better than London? Just less competition for the stage time?
Yeah, you know what? I recommend, there's less competition. It's a smaller hub, good community. It's also the middle of the country. So if you're a good standard comedian and you live in Manchester, if anybody drops out or if a club has a problem in Newcastle or Leeds or Liverpool or Sheffield or Birmingham, they're going to call a comic from Manchester to drive there because he'll get there quicker than they will London. So it's the perfect thing to do when you're a new comic. Like, I highly recommend it to all new comics in Britain. I'm like, no, go to Manchester first because you're there to capitalize on lots of last minute opportunities and you can get your name around a lot quicker before going down to London and swimming through the shit.
I played the Manchester Comedy Store at Dean's Gate Lock probably, I don't know, 8-10 times. And had some very debaucherous evenings in Manchester. What, there's that...
Yeah.
It's some kind of like seedy gay bar by the train station.
Well, the...
Where you can get a drink after like 2 in the morning.
Oh, there's the strip club. I know you can get... Yeah.
I remember there's some seedy... I don't know if it was a gay place, but it was
really
like...
seedy, sweaty strip club.
It seemed gay because it was a lot of like, you know...
Right.
Transsexuals there and... people who kept sniffing and touching their noses.
That sounds like the Dean's Gate.
They were very well dressed.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole Manchester era. You know, that whole Dean's Gate locks. It was a druggy mess back in the 90s. So that's where the Hacienda is and everything. You know. The old gay guys in a little pub. They'll be left over from that era. You know, still sitting there waiting for you to wander in.
Well, what's the best thing you learned from the Manchester period?
Well, like you were just saying, it's a debacle, but Manchester, I don't know what you thought of the Comedy Store. It's a weird...
Great room, yeah. It's almost set up like a theater.
Yeah, set up like a theater, but the toilets are in behind the stage. So you ever notice how... Because they're the most peacockingest crowd, I think, in Britain. So they're always getting up in the middle of your shows, you know. So it's a bit... Manchester comedy, it's the most full contact comedy, I think, in Britain. You know, you really got to... learn to keep their attention, you know, and they've got that northern attitude towards them as well, where they're not as ready to accept outsiders, you know, so it's a good place to cut your teeth, I'd say.
And what about the London period? I mean, and you know, you're living with those great comedians.
Yeah.
And,
well, we love living together, that's for sure. I think, yeah, we had a blast.
What's the wildest stories you have living with Steve Hughes? And
I don't know.
Jim Jefferies.
Our stories usually involve...
Because there's a Jim Jefferies famous story where he got punched on stage at the Comedy Store in Manchester.
Yeah.
We have to mention that. But both those guys, they like to get it on, shall we say, as far as...
We had a party imbibing. Flat. We definitely had a party flat going on in Manchester. We had, you know what, for the same price as we had like a little 3-bedroom in Walthamstow in northeast London, we got a 5-bedroom in Manchester with a big back garden and a driveway, you know, so we were able to have spare bedrooms. Every comic who came up from London to Manchester would crash at our house and stuff, so we had quite a little party flat going.
No stories you can regale the listener with?
Well, I don't know, we got a whole bunch of stories, but they mostly involve Steve Hughes freaking out, which was always entertaining.
Steve would flip out?
Steve's known for his short temper.
Oh, you mean anger? I thought you meant like a bad drug trip or something.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. I'm sure he's had a few bad drug trips too, but I recall him in the backyard yelling at people for lighting fireworks on bonfire night, which is the night when they're supposed to light fireworks. But we've got an Australian in the backyard just yelling at every neighbor going, "Shut the fuck up! Stop fucking doing this!" And me and Jim are just out there trying to calm him down and going, they're allowed to do it tonight, Steve. It's all right. You know, perfectly acceptable. So but that was a usual occurrence for him.
And you're still great friends with Jim Jefferies? You just opened for him on his...
Yeah.
What is...
On this American tour of his, what's it called? Daystreaming. is the name of the tour.
But yeah, they filmed a special and everything. You guys did all these, like, Turn Theater in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, it was the Wilbur in Boston. Yeah, we just shot his new DVD, and I recorded some stuff there as well. And yeah, that was the primary excuse that I had for coming to America as well. You know, I was like...
So obviously you must have held Jim's hair while he vomited a few times. I mean, you guys are still good buddies.
Yeah, a couple times. I've seen him cry. I've seen him cry. It was a fun era. I also remember we used to have signals between our bedrooms to knock on the walls when we had women over and stuff. So.
That's your girl has just, you know, mentally decided she's going to have sex with you. And then she's like, why is the guy banging on the wall six times in odd rhythms?
Just trying to see if my flatmate's having sex too. We got to finish at the same time. Congratulate each other. Yeah, man. Yeah, it was a good time. It was a good little era in comedy. Good place to be.
And so what about London? Then you guys all moved back to London?
Yeah, then we all moved back to London, like, eventually, like, or individually, we all moved back to London. Do you know about the break-in that happened in Manchester? Because both Jim and Steve have talked about it on stage.
Where they got robbed at Machete Point?
Yeah, robbing at Machete Point. That was the destruction of our house. So that happened, I was in Australia, I was doing an Australian tour at the time, and they had this big break-in. And
they were there?
They were in the house. Yeah, they got held hostage, basically, for an hour and a half, you know? And the guy stole all our stuff, stole Jim's car. Wouldn't have got caught if he hadn't ran a curb. Apparently, when he was driving away, he ran a curb. And so the cops thought he was intoxicated. So they engaged in a big chase. Meanwhile, back at the house, Steve and Jim are cutting themselves free.
Wow.
And calling the cops.
Tied them up and everything.
Yeah, man.
Only in England.
I went to the trial. Saw them at the trial and everything. You know, I got that guilt of not being there, but what can I do? I went and watched them. The two of them got 12 years and 10 years. And then they each got an additional 2 years for possession. But the funny thing is that the drugs were ours. It was the drugs that they had stolen from us. Got them an extra 2 years each. So, but yeah, sad to say, that ended our massive party house because the guys didn't want to be there anymore and, you know, right. It was quite a traumatic incident. So Jim ended up moving out with his girlfriend to a place like in Didsbury in East Manchester, whatever, West Manchester. Steve got a place in town. I got back, grabbed my stuff, and just went back to London, got my own place. And then eventually they made their ways down to London as well. But yeah, ruined our house, man. What a bunch of cunts.
So what was the London experience like? I mean, you know, what great stories do you have? What are the most debaucherous moments, the most human depravity witness, greatest comedy moments? Many brilliant comedians are in London.
Yeah, especially in North London, in the Crouch End, Muswell Hill area. You know, do you know about the Clown House?
No.
So there's like a 5-bedroom house. It's not around anymore. A 5-bedroom house up in Crouch End that's had a rotation of comedians there over the last, like over probably a decade, you know, leading up until, I think they probably got rid of the house like 3 years ago. But yeah, they used to have some insane parties there and you'd see people tripping out in their backyard and hiding people in the woods to avoid guilt. You know, but just good, basic, messy comedian parties.
How did you feel as a Canadian in England? I mean, you don't get the same racism as Americans and Australians. They talk about Americans like they're dogs.
Yeah.
And the only people they speak worse of are Australians. So Canadians, you guys are, you get kind of a free spin there.
Yeah, I think we slip under the radar a little bit. We always initially get attacked for being American, you know. And then we have to use that defense mechanism. Like, no, we're Canadian. It's, oh, all right, pal. You're all right.
I'm sorry you think I'm American.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. You poor guys, man. You've got to fight your reputation all the time. I think the traveling Americans are getting better at it, though. You know, I think Americans travel better now than they did 10 years ago.
Oh, it's a lot better than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, just
the
definitely.
Climate.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So...
You're not faced with such open hostility as you would get periodically.
It's the American confidence, I think. When American walks into a room, they tend to have a lot more confidence in front of strangers, and I think the British see that as a challenge to tear you down. And I think Canadians come into a room with their shoulders slump kind shoulders. Of curved and go, "Are you guys all right if I hang out here with you for a bit? I'll be nice." Yeah.
What were some of your comedic highlights in London?
Well, I don't know. It all depends on where we're going. I loved it. I love being a comedian, you know, and I love being a comedian in London, doing a lot of English TV and stuff. And the other great thing about being in London is that you're so quick to get to Europe, you know. I've only been here for like 4 or 5 months now, but you start to realize all the places that you've traveled, and you know, like, and you're able to go, oh yeah, I did comedy in Holland and Norway and Sweden and there's people here who are going, really? How did you do that? And it kind of happens easily when you're based out of London. If a promoter knows about you,
yeah,
you know, it's only a couple hour flight. So I mean, that's just a great start to a comedy career, I guess, to, you know, to cover Europe at the beginning.
Right, starting from London. I mean, London was the key for me to getting in with all this international work. What is the greatest vacation you ever took?
Well, we were in Bali, weren't we?
Yeah.
which still wouldn't count as a vacation, would it? Because technically we were working. But that is what we comedians do, don't we? We combine our gigs abroad with holiday. We'll call it a holiday. Take a couple of days off after the gig. So, I love that time in Bali. It was great.
Yeah.
We went and rode the elephants. I remember that being a highlight that I normally wouldn't pursue. So, greatest holiday. This whole job's been a holiday, hasn't it? So I've been on vacation for 15 years.
What are some of your most memorable, like, international gigs or toughest moments?
Yeah, well, the toughest moments, I mean, I guess the hardest gigs you're going to find are the further north you go in Britain, I think, you know.
The hardest.
Yeah, like the most, where the crowds are the most vocal, where they're going to...
Is Scotland like that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think Scotland will hang you out to dry if you, you know, if you step the wrong way. I remember I died on my ass about 8 gigs in. I remember being cocky for my first 7 gigs, you know, and still living up in Scotland and thinking, I'm pretty good at this. I'm good. This is all right. I remember showing up at the stand on a Saturday night for gig number 8, and it was a whole bunch of firefighters, a whole bunch of Scottish firefighters. And just from the word go, they fucking hated me. You know, they hated the accent. So I said hello, and they're like, oh, this guy's toast. And I just got heckled to bits. I was a crumbling shame when I walked off stage, came backstage. And that was the initiation to the comedian camaraderie, too, because all the comics loved it. They loved the massive death from the cocky kid who's 8 gigs into his career. But, it was relentless.
Are there any poker players in tonight? Yeah! Yeah, here's my complaint about online poker. I don't care. You're playing online poker, fine, but you get to pick a little picture to represent yourself around the poker table. And I don't care what you pick is your photo, you know, picture of yourself, picture of your pet, or your sports team, that's all cool. But please, if you're going to be gambling on the internet, don't put up pictures of your children. It looks wrong. And I hate staring at a photo of little Timmy, age 6, smiling at me all buck-toothed, fresh from the family barbecue, watching my money slide across the table to the little shit. And I understand that it's his mother or his grandmother that's put the picture up there, but it looks wrong. Especially considering you can gamble on the internet in the comfort of your own home, naked. As I was doing last week when my flatmate came home to catch me standing nude in front of a computer screen with pictures of small children on it. And I'm yelling at the monitor, come on, I've given you all my money. Now, show me what you got. I can see the way some of you are looking at me, giving me that look of this is all fine and well with your jokey jokes, Jay. But quite obviously, you seem like the kind of guy who could give us all some advice. Well, you've come to the right guy. I've got advice for you all, because it's going to be important for the rest of this year, not only to save some money, but to also stretch your cash a little bit further. And that's why, when you go to the strip club tonight, you want to get the deaf stripper. Because there's a slight chance she might not know when the song ended. And then her friend will have to come over and tell her, and that's like getting a two for one. You're way ahead of me on that one, Jay. Yeah, if anybody wanted to be offended by that because it was a deaf stripper, fuck off. My friend is a deaf stripper, and she doesn't give a shit that I'm telling that joke. That's right, she's never heard me tell her. I realize, too, we just went through a flu season, and I'm feeling guilty about my behavior because one of my friends... Well, you see, I feel sad when my friends fall ill, but I just realized that I get a little bit happier if they fall ill with a rare illness. I realize that sounds cruel, but it's because of this. Because if they're really good friends, then they'll let you try their drugs. It's very straightforward. What's that? You got the flu. I hope you get better soon. What's that? You got vertigo. I'll be right over. Maybe your pills will give me super balance. They didn't. But I had all her drugs, and then she couldn't get any better, so she kept falling over. It's a pretty good Saturday night.
You've done the full-on month-long run at Edinburgh, haven't you?
Yeah, I've done 8 Edinburgh shows now.
Have you really?
Yeah.
You've done 8 different hour shows?
Yeah, 8 shows. I did my first one in 2001. I won the BBC Comedy Award in Edinburgh in 2000, then went back and did my first hour-long show in 2001, and I did it, and I didn't take a year off until 2006, and I've gone back like every couple of years since 2006. So, yeah, I mean, it's great. You're going over there to do your first one, right?
Doing my first one, that's yeah. There will be no other.
I mean, you know what?
You're getting this hour only.
Oh, dude, sometimes that's the way you want it.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing better than your first one.
Yeah.
First one's great because it's your greatest hits. It's your introduction to them.
Are you going
to
spend the next year coming up with a new hour?
I'm not going to theme some shit.
So, like, did you have, like, themes? Did you cry over, like, a dog that was killed?
Yeah, I never got my themes.
Did you have your sad moment?
My themes, yeah, I had a tear on my cheek and my poster in, like, 2009.
Did you?
Yeah, it was called, my show in 2009 was called Emotional White Male.
That's and, good. Yeah. So, but did you cry each performance?
No, man.
I mean, because if I see a poster and the guy's crying, I'm going to want to see some tears during the show.
Yeah.
That's false advertising.
Sorry for lying, man. Yeah, that's all right. False advertising in Edinburgh is rife. There's a lot of people that call themselves comedians.
What were you emotional about in that performance?
I've done a lot of shows about ex-girlfriends. I think that sounds pitiful, but I think that's... You got to write what you know.
You got to, yeah. And, I mean, that's...
And a lot of my material would be about a relationship or... I mean, dating material is funny, you know? So yeah, that's... The show was about a girl. And I did... My last Edinburgh show was about a girl as well. So that seems to be...
So every big heartbreak, you get a new show.
Yeah, my first shows were not. My first show was called Immigrant. So my first show was about me getting used to British culture, you know, and so all the comedy was derived of, you know, cultural differences. And
what should a non-Briton know about living in Britain?
There's a long list. So I don't know. To get, you got to be ready for an easy drinking culture, you know, which I guess everybody's aware of now. I don't know where to start on that.
I was in London 2 years ago, and I had to have an emergency root canal. And you can't imagine how relieved I was to find out that they had dentists in England.
Oh, yeah, man. There's some bad ones, though. You got to be careful.
We Americans love that stereotype.
Some of them are true. The food is shit. They're incredibly happy with mediocrity there. In fact, they're surprised when things go well. There's something in the English psyche that they like things to be a little bit shit. You know?
Yeah.
You know, and they use sarcasm a lot. That'll go over a lot of Americans' heads, I think. You know, they'll challenge you with some sarcasm. But overall, I always like to say that English people are the only ones who, because you can have that kind of sarcasm and that attitude towards life. Sometimes if you tell an American that that life is shit or whatever, then your American friend will get concerned. Oh, are you okay?
Are you going to commit suicide?
Yeah, but if you tell a British person that you think life is shit, they'll just go, fucking rights, man. It is shit. You know, if you say, how was your day? And you say, oh, I'm having a shit day. Your British friend will say, oh, I'm having a better day now that I know yours is shit. So, but that's British camaraderie.
What benefit do you have as a Canadian white male? I mean, everybody loves Canada. Where can't you play? You can go into the deepest depths of the Congo and put on shows.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. I haven't found a place where we're not welcome. I'm wondering if it's going to happen in America. Are there not pockets of America where you guys are sick of Canadians?
You're our number one trading partner.
Right, okay.
I mean...
So, because I was thinking, like, what about,
yang and yang,
what about
baby.
Here in Hollywood? Are you
Peanut
sick of all these
gel,
Canadians coming down to Hollywood and stuff?
Yeah.
And yeah, we are.
Well, I remember when I lived here in... it's funny, you started in 98 because I had a canceled sitcom by then. I was living here in 96, 97. I had the sitcom and I was dating a Canadian girl.
Right.
And I was crazy about this girl, but she only hung out with other Canadian actors.
Right.
So here I am and I'm in LA and, you know, I'm no flag waver, but Jesus Christ, after like your 28th like wine after dinner party, listening to these people bitch about everything that is
high in ice hockey.
Just bitching about everything that's wrong with America. And I'm thinking, you know, I didn't say it out loud, but I'm like, you know, all of you are here trying to benefit and make your name in this American entertainment system. You know, you should shut the fuck up.
Yeah, check your grudges at the door. Totally. Every culture's got something fucked up about it anyway, so you gotta learn to just accept it, you know? At least, hey, you guys got Obamacare now, so
and what is it
changes
like,
everything.
But, we're almost Canadian now.
starting to take care of each other.
There is that Canadian filming rule where you have to have, 30% of the cast has to be Canadian?
I don't know if that's I don't know if it's a casting rule, but yeah, it's called CanCon.
It was just a porno company that's going to use, they're going to film more in Canada and use more Canadian porn actors.
Oh, well, we are very good lovers. So, But yeah, it's true. CanCon laws, you have to play 30 or 33% like Canadian music on the radio and stuff. And I think it's good. You think it promotes our own culture. We've got good musicians and stuff. So why not? 33% isn't much. You know, you go to, and then you go over to Europe and stuff and you realize they do that naturally anyway. They're going to promote their own artists.
Do you think you could ever live in Canada again?
I don't know. Life's a bit slow.
You're too fancy now, aren't you?
I don't know if you call sweating in the heat fancy, but the pace of life's a bit slow. And I was never from a big city, like a military family. So we lived on the West Coast for a little bit in Victoria, Vancouver Island, as well as Nova Scotia. But, you know, whenever I go, and I was in Vancouver or Victoria, Vancouver Island last year as well, but also Nova Scotia, life's quite slow and calm and... you know, I think I was meant to be in a busier city, I guess. So yeah, I don't know. I think I'd like to find a way to be here for long term, you know. I'm not in a rush to go back to the English rain. And as much as I've liked Australia and New Zealand and thought about it every now and then, I think this is the...
I could live in Australia and New Zealand. Oh,
it's gorgeous, yeah. Isn't it?
But like, I know English people, like if they, comedians or actors try and come to Los Angeles, the English culture kind of feels like, oh, why the fuck do they need to go there? Why, you know, aren't we good enough? You Canadians, you also don't have that. I mean, you don't have the restriction of the judgment of your entire nation because you decided to want to go to Los Angeles.
Yeah, I don't know. To a certain extent, I think it's still, you can still get some judgment. But I think this is, yeah, it's exciting to come here. And you know what? Los Angeles is, like, Los Angeles is even 30 times bigger than London. You know, as far as the entertainment scene goes. So you can just see that there's more directions that your career can go, more things to inspire you, more things to do. And also the pace of life here, I'm finding that I'm able to meet up with people more, you know, and like being in LA. And that was happening less and less in London. Like, I think 2012 and 2013, I probably spent about 8 months of the 12 months in both of those years on the road, you know, just missing people. All of a sudden, my relationships with all my friends who are fellow comedians and stuff, they had evolved into phone calls and like, oh, you're in Holland tonight. Oh, you're in Norway. Oh, when are you back? Oh, we're back on Sunday. Oh, let's hang out Sunday night. And then we're off somewhere else on Monday. And so...
Right. Well, I've seen you more since you've been in Los Angeles.
Yeah, there you go.
I've seen you a lot.
Yeah.
Which, and we have to talk about when I saw you, what was it, a month ago at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
And that kid got punched
yeah.
in the face.
That was funny. Your instigation.
I recently just started going back to the Comedy Store. I used to avoid that place. We're sitting out on the front patio area.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Mike Favorman. He's got a like kind of taxi driver looking newsstand guy hat on.
There's Rouse.
Sean Rouse is sitting there. He's completely plastered.
Jason Rouse.
Had way too much vodka. And Sean Rouse is bald and skinny. And Jason Rouse, who's got tons of tattoos.
Covered in tats. He's like the dark man of
comedy. We got loads of mutual friends like you and Steve Hughes. And yeah. I'd always heard about Jason Rouse. I just met him.
Yeah.
And I know he's a good guy because we have all these mutual friends.
And that's exactly what the banter was around the table. There was like me, you, Faberman. Like we all were having these great talks. It was, the vibe was great at our table. And so, by whoever that...
This guy comes up, young guy, I don't know, 25, 27, somewhere in that area. And he's making fun of Jason Rouse for all the tattoos on his arm.
Yeah.
And making fun of his appearance and everything. And I'm thinking, you guys must know this kid. No. I recognize this kid. I saw him...
Yeah, I think he overheard me because Rouse had a whole bunch of spikes on his jacket. All these little metal spikes. And I, maybe within earshot of the kid, I did say to Jason Rouse, I was like, oh, I see you've been doing some bedazzling tonight. You know, just to rib Jason. But that's something that we're allowed to do to each other. It's like the N-word, isn't it? It's like, no, look, comics, we've known each other for years. We're allowed to sit around. But I think that kid heard that, and then he just thought, oh, you guys are all busting balls.
I've seen this kid do this before, and I ran into him probably 6 months earlier, I think, at the Improv, and he said something to me about, like, being an old man or something like that. That, like, you know, I thought, who's this fucking dick?
Yeah.
So he comes up. He's making fun of Jason Rouse, and I say to all you guys, do you guys know this guy? Because I thought he knew you guys.
Yeah, no.
And I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe this guy's Canadian or something. And so he's just doing this like eighth grade thing where he's making, and then he starts making fun of you, saying something to you, and then he goes, I'm sorry, gentlemen, I just couldn't pass up the chance to meet Moby. And he like sticks his hand out to Sean Rouse, who can barely lift his head. He's so drunk.
Yeah.
But he's bald. He looks like Moby. Get it?
Yeah.
so not funny and so eighth grade. And then he turns to Mike Faverman and he says, I guess I'll be seeing you tomorrow morning when I come pick up my New York Times at the newsstand.
Yeah.
Because he's got like the...
Oh, he's fucking out of line. But
and this is a table of
all these lines that you're saying right now. I'm like, oh, right. They'd be all right coming from you. But from some shit who's just stepped up. Because I remember just looking at him going, what are you doing? And then you...
I turned to Mike Faverman and I said, I'll give you $20 if you punch this kid in the face.
But and to be fair, you didn't say that until he had had enough warning. He had had several warnings.
Well, and I meant it like a joke, too. Yeah. I didn't expect Mike Faverman to... He didn't miss a beat. Yeah, he reached back and punched this kid in the face. And then everybody's being held back and the kid's screaming. And it was... This big production,
you want to go? You want to go? And he should have just...
But, you know, as a young comedian, you don't walk up to a table of veterans and, like, start making fun of everybody for their appearance.
Yeah, you got to bite your tongue, man.
And that was interesting. The guy wanted the club to call the cops, and the manager came out, and he got everyone's story, and the manager said, sorry, Mike's a paid regular, and you're not, so that decides it.
Yeah.
And then the kid didn't want to leave the sidewalk, and he's...
Yeah, no, he was still... Well, he was in shock, wasn't he? He didn't... He wouldn't know what to do at that point, would he? He's like, oh, this is where I want to hang out, too. I just got punched at the Comedy Store.
I hate to say it. The kid deserved it. I don't know if you read The Three Musketeers, but D'Artagnan was not a musketeer. D'Artagnan was a young punk who wanted to be a Three Musketeer. And the other Three Musketeers... for the whole book, are beating D'Artagnan's ass.
All right, okay.
And telling him, you know, look, you're a punk and you need to learn and you need to, you know, get smacked across the chops.
Yeah.
And we remember D'Artagnan because it's such a sexy name. But he was a young punk. He wasn't a Three Musketeer.
Yeah, you got to bite your tongue.
At the end, he makes it, but...
I can remember the comics who put me through the ropes when I was new. You know, Craig Campbell... In Britain, Craig Campbell, Phil Nickel.
Wild man. Jesus.
Yeah.
Love Craig.
Well, they were terrifying and intimidating to me, you know? And I don't think I was ever out of line, but I definitely felt as the new comic entering that circle of these veteran Canadian comics, you know, living in Britain, I felt that I wouldn't step out of line, you know? And that's where I became friends with Wooly as well and stuff, but... Yeah, they would. They used to give me shit, you know, initiate you a bit, get the skin a little bit tougher for the next time you're going to die on your ass in front of a bunch of firefighters.
So all you Canadian guys, I mean, you did have camaraderie, your own...
yeah, I think a lot of the expats, you evolved to be a little group of friends, you know. We had a good little group up in northeast London. Phil Nickel is still there today.
Love Phil.
And Kerry Marks, still up there. Craig Campbell's moved out to the country.
You know? I've been out to his place in Devon. It's beautiful out
there. Yeah. He always wanted to go somewhere where he can chop wood all day.
It's beautiful. they belong to some like neighborhood collective where they put money... they give money to whoever, and once a week they get a big box of vegetables, locally grown vegetables, put on their door. And it's like whatever there's an abundance of. It was really cool.
Yeah, it's very
cool. They had a really pimp-ass big vegetable box.
Yeah,
and then they buy their meat locally and all that.
It's a great little community. Did you do their show down there as well?
No.
Jane runs...
Oh, yeah, I did do that show.
That's show as well.
Yeah.
And all the whole community shows up for it. And, Yeah, it's pretty cool.
What is the greatest advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
To let things go. Eddie Izzard once told me, take your best piece of material and let it go, or you're not going to grow as a comic next time you're on stage. And that took a while to sink in. Because you don't realize it until you sit back and look at your material and go, wow, I have been doing this one bit forever and I can't let it go. And I always think, ooh, it's a go-to thing. And and then once you drop it, this hole will start to fill up in your set. So that was always a good piece of advice, because I was at a point where I was thinking, no, my best joke stays. It's my best joke always stays. And it's the weaker ones that can go away. And Eddie Izzard was like, no, ditch your best one. Leave that one behind, you know? And then the other good advice I got once was a comic, Tom Staid. I was performing a few nights with him. And I remember he told me to stop moving on stage because I was walking around a lot. And I gave it a shot. I stood stationary at the mic and it added a new level. And I remember staying like that for for about 6 months. So now what I try to do is I try to go through phases. So every now and then, you know, just change it up. If you've become a pacing guy back and forth, try to consciously not pace for a set. Stick the mic in, stand in the middle of the stage and bring them to you for a while. I think it's good to change it up every now and then, you know. The advice that Tom Staid gave me at the time was to always just stay standing still. But I think it helped me realize that you can change the dynamic of your delivery, you know, and find a new level every now and then.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, a small club stage is perfect for me because I like to pace. And that keeps me, like, contained. But then, like, when you get to do a theater gig, then it's like there's so much more space to cover.
Yeah.
And then it's like it's a whole different movement, moving around too much.
Yeah. See, I really like the pacing, too. Like, I pace back and forth and stuff. And I feel like it gets the crowd into
it. I like to go to the front of the stage, too.
Yeah, me too, man.
I call it playing the net. I always thought... those John McEnroe, Bjorn Borg Wimbledons were like the greatest tennis matches ever. And I remember watching those. And McEnroe used to play the front of the net a lot. It was his big dick rock and roll move. He would go, he'd be right at the front of the net and just smashing the shit out of everything. And so a lot of the times I like to stand right at the front edge of the stage.
So do I.
It's the play in the net.
It feels more intimate as well.
Yeah.
It feels
like, so, I mean, I move around, you know, and then I one of the best advice I ever got was shit in all four corners, which is, you know, don't just stand there, move around.
Right. Yeah.
So somewhere between don't move too much and shit in all four corners is the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. See, you got to remember that if you ever feel that you're in a rut... Because the first thing, when I feel that I'm in a rut or something, I automatically analyze my jokes. You know, I'm going to go to my writing. And then sometimes sometimes I forget. Like, oh, maybe I'll just try to be stationary more, just to switch it up somehow. See if I can add a new dynamic, find a new way to hold your head. You know, you never know. But there's so many little intricate details that you can change. Outside of just the writing and the jokes, you know?
What is what joke have you written that you're the most proud of?
Ooh. That's a tough one. You know what? There's a story that I wrote recently that I really like. It's my favorite bit that I'm delivering right now, which probably means it's got to go soon. But... I've enjoyed doing that because it's, I don't know, you know when you write a story and you realize, oh, right, I've got these extra skills now outside of just writing a short joke, you know, the ability to weave a story and have little nice attentions to detail and stuff. So I think that's my current favorite, but I don't know. There's all the little short jokes and stuff. Give me an example of your favorite joke then. Like, what? Is it a
of
short,
my act? Yeah, is it well, I mean, and it's like, I know exactly what you're saying. The mix the races joke, I think was like the best joke I wrote. And then I stopped doing it for years. And then I brought it back a couple years ago. I was like, wow, it's like relevant. And it still works.
Yeah, right.
And I liked what it said. And it's about mixing the races, you know. And then I wrote a joke about... the United States is like Elvis in Vegas, you know, with fat, bloated period with the jumpsuit and everything. Those are jokes that I thought, wow, those were great.
Good, unique observations.
That, you know, my favorite kind of comedy is, you know, stuff that you learn from or like that says something.
Oh, yeah.
You know, comedy that, I mean, you don't want to be like, you know, preachy or on a soapbox, but like if you can manage to make something funny and enlighten the fucking person who's hearing it at the same time, yeah, that's the best kind of humor.
You get that clever little,
you know. And then I've gone through periods where, like, because I, a long time ago, I thought about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, I was like, God, why do I always have to be trying to save the world in every joke?
Right.
Or I was trying too much of that. And then I tried to think of, like, a lot of silly jokes,
yeah,
to combat my fucking, you know, want to save the world.
Right. Making poignant political observations.
Right. I mean, you got to mix it up.
That's, yeah, because that's definitely, as you can tell by my Edinburgh shows, I've always been kind of silly or kind of, I've never been political or religion based. Sometimes I have a think, like, that thought crossed my mind a few days ago, when I got to write some religious stuff. I got to have an opinion. But you know what? I don't have a strong opinion. I mean, I love being a comedian. I love to entertain. But yeah, I don't feel politically motivated. Maybe that's the Canadian who's lived in Britain in me too. I've never felt too terribly politically motivated or needing to change.
Well, your government
things.
Isn't destroying the world.
Yeah. So
what's there to worry about?
Yeah, so I'm able to just get by. Exactly. What's there to worry about? Just ex-girlfriends, and that's why you write a show called Emotional White Male.
Now, we met in Sydney, Australia.
We did, yeah. We met, we were crossing paths as well. I think, or maybe you were just getting into town.
And you just finished, that was it,
and
right?
I had just finished my run at the Comedy Store. Yeah, I think I had just finished my run at the Comedy Store. You were just arriving to start yours. And we met, like, outside the boutique hotel lobby. And I was like, Tom Rhodes. You're like, hey, man, it was late at night, too. And you had a couple bottles of wine. I had some other goodies. And we went up to my room and we partied.
Oh, and instantly when we met, morning. We went up and drank. And, yeah. Oh, that's great.
And that was how we met, yeah.
That's great.
That was fantastic. And then I didn't see you again for a couple weeks, I think, because you did your run. But I went off on the road. And then we met up in, like, we did, like, Jakarta and stuff together.
Yeah.
Jakarta and Bali and...
I filmed that great interview with you in Jakarta where you're in the bathtub.
Oh, yeah.
with bubbles and stuff.
Yeah, we had to keep replenishing the bubbles.
Yeah.
You remember the chick's hair caught on fire in Jakarta?
Oh, my
that?
God, at the show.
Do you remember that?
That was hilarious.
That was brilliant.
Was that when you were on stage?
Yeah, I was on stage.
Because I was in the back of the room. I saw.
Yeah.
It was funny. There was all these rows of tables. And nice small club. It was on the roof of, like, a Moroccan restaurant.
Yeah.
And it was a really cool, like, roofed outdoor area. And then there was a small room up there where they did the comedy.
Yeah.
And it was rows of tables, and they had actual burning candles. And this woman with this big mane of puffy, frizzy hair leaned back while she was laughing. And it all went up.
Yeah.
And there's this terrible smell of burnt hair in the room.
I liked how the smell didn't happen until, like, a minute later.
Yeah.
And I warned the whole audience, because her hair went up in fire. Remember, everybody's putting it out. And then I said to everybody, I said, okay, we should probably take a break, everybody, because the room's going to stink. And everybody, because weirdly enough, it's not the first time someone's hair's caught on fire at a gig. So I knew what was coming. I remember giving them all the warning, and they're like, no, carry on, it'll be fine. And then I remember going back into my set, and sure enough, about a minute later, everybody was gagging and coughing, and I'm like,
but
see,
it's great.
There it is.
A thought that you produced in your head and came out of your mouth made that woman laugh.
So hard.
She leaned back into a burning flame.
Yeah, and ruined her scalp.
I was in Fort Worth, Texas, I don't know, about 5 years ago, and then this guy started choking, and fortunately, the people at the next table were, like, paramedics who were on vacation.
Right.
From wherever. They were from, like, Kansas or something in Fort Worth. And the guy at the next table jumps up, and he gives the dude the Heimlich, and then he's okay. But then, and this is all while I'm on stage.
Yeah.
And then the
you're just carrying on, or were you watching?
I was watching it. Yeah. I mean, it was a frightening moment.
Yeah.
It was really tense. I was like, you know, I was calling for someone to call for help when the guy was doing the Heimlich. It was a really tense, frightening moment, you know, where I hope this guy's okay. And then the ambulance stretcher comes in, and they pulled the guy out, and he was giving the thumbs up. He was fine by that point, but... the owner of the club, I talked to later, and he said, yeah, he talked to the guy. I said, well, did he choke on like a pretzel or some food? He goes, no. The guy said that he actually was laughing at a joke so hard, it turned into a coughing fit.
Well and done, said, man.
I told the story on stage the next night. I go, my friends call me and go, so did you kill tonight? I was like, no, but I choked a bitch.
Came close. Get ready for Edinburgh, man, because it might happen again. It gets so hot in the Edinburgh rooms.
Really?
Yeah, and because there's a lot of temporary rooms, and also just these old buildings are not built for this influx of people.
I thought it was like chilly up, and, cold up there.
No. It's cold outdoors.
Yeah.
But inside, under the theatrical lights, because they'll import all the lights and stuff, all these stages will be set up in these rooms. Some of the rooms are only like office spaces during the year.
Wow.
And now they'll have these big flood, like big theater lights and stuff heating it up. You'll literally be performing to Scottish crowds while the steam will be rising off them from being outside in the rain.
Wow.
They'll be inside. And so it gets hot and muggy in your rooms. And so
I can't even. Suit. He's gonna be brutal.
It'll be tough. You'll probably get sick of the suit after a couple of days. But I had a lady pass out pretty bad in one of my shows once, and I've had a few people get faint during the shows. It's guerrilla comedy sometimes. Some of these rooms are really hot. You know, you can get lucky and get a nice one, but a lot of the rooms are like saunas.
Do you have any advice for me to do before doing Edinburgh? I'm not drinking. I'm not partying.
Well, that's great.
Only reason I decided, oh fuck, I'll try it this year.
Yeah,
because I always thought it was an endurance race, and I've visited the festival while it was happening, and saw friends of mine that looked ill from just the partying and the drinking and the stress and.
Yeah, totally. That's a good start if you're gonna. Yeah, take it seriously because it is although it is a party. It is a trade fair, you know, and like your professionalism gets noticed and like, you know, I mean, sure, you can be drinking late at night and meet a promoter from Sweden who'll go, oh, I want to fly you over to do my festival or whatever. But at the same time, you're going to meet some other people who will want to see sober Tom, who's, you know, on the ball and banging out a good show.
Sober on the ball Tom is a whole new experience.
Yeah. Well, that's. Yeah, so it's good. Yeah, you got to treat it like the trade fair that it is. Know that your reputation is always on the line outside of your shows as well. You know, that's a really good way to approach it. And then outside of that, I don't know. I'd always say be aware of the 45-minute mark of your show. That's a big one, I think, because you're doing 55 minutes, right? You're doing hour-long shows, but it's like 55 minutes really is what you're aiming for. But every audience in Edinburgh. They flag big time between 40 to 45. So sometimes...
What do you mean flag?
Like, they're hot and tired, and their minds will start to wander, and they'll sink in their chairs, and they're done. And there's this spot in your Edinburgh show at the 40 to 45 minute mark where you could lose them for that last 10 minutes. And they'll just leave the show going, oh, let's get out of here.
Wow.
Right? And so sometimes... Sometimes you want to make little adjustments, like maybe your big closer that you have, which you would do in a nicely air-conditioned theater, which you would do from the 50 to 55-minute mark, you might want to move it up to the 45-minute mark just to get that energy in the room and to just go. I mean, a lot of my Edinburgh shows, I acknowledge the 45-minute mark. I actually end up saying to the audience, we're almost there, guys. You know, this is it. Like, you know, just kind of shrug your shoulders a bit. Let's go. Let's wind this puppy up. Because it's hard. There's comics that hand out fans, you know, to the audience. Rob Rouse, really good English comic, one year, he'd get everybody popsicles. And at the 45-minute mark, he gave everybody popsicles just to give them that little boost, you know, so they'd hang out for the rest of the show. But yeah, that's a tough...
That's good advice, bro.
Tough mark in Edinburgh. You gotta, you know... And if you forget about that between now and then, you'll notice it in your first couple of shows. You'll end up after the show going, they kind of chilled out at about 45.
About the city of Edinburgh? Any good travel tips?
You can go see castles and stuff. Have you been to Edinburgh?
I went to the Tattoo when I first went to Edinburgh. It was chilly.
Yeah.
And I never liked the bagpipe. I always thought was like irritating sound. And then I went and saw the tattoo at the Edinburgh Castle and was like,
oh, that would be cool.
My God.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, the things you say in your life, like, you know, oh, I fucking don't like that or I hate that. Like, I always thought stock car racing was stupid.
Right.
My brother took me to a Daytona 500 in 2007. And oh my God, once those cars rip past you and you, that roar of the engines and shit shakes your inside, then you go, oh, I get it.
Right,
You know, you're at Edinburgh Castle and then the dudes are playing the bagpipes, all the other, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yeah, you man. Know? Yeah, you can get into it while you're there. Yeah, that's great. I was just going to tell you a drinking thing that you can do, but we'll skip that.
Tell me.
There's these great pubs called the Jekyll and... They're the Jekyll and Hyde. Maybe the Jekyll and Hyde's one of the chains. They've got like six of them dotted around Edinburgh, and they're all themed. They're all old school themed. There's one called the Old Fire Station.
Yeah.
So it's Jekyll and Hyde. And Jekyll and Hyde is set up like a Jekyll and Hyde. Like the toilets are hidden behind a bookcase.
So Robert Louis Stevenson wrote Jekyll and Hyde.
You know what? I guess so. Is that a yes?
I think so. And so it was a story actually where it was alcohol. That it was like a doctor.
Right.
It was a story where like the guy drank. That was the potion that turned Dr. Jekyll into Mr. Hyde.
Wait until you see the Jekyll and Hyde bar. Because it's got his lab is all there and stuff. You know, go have dinner and you can see all the pill boxes and all the, you know, samples of people or whatever it is. And it's a pretty cool little theme chain. And I remember when my buddies came over from Canada initially in like 99 when they came over, we did the, if you go and have a beer at each of their pubs, they're called Erie Pubs. That's, and they'll give you a t-shirt and stuff. And that was a fun thing to do with a bunch of guys.
They stamp your passport.
And did they stamp your passport? No, they deported a couple of my friends though quickly. But, outside of that, I'd say, and then hit up the castles and, you know, Edinburgh's just a really fun town. Nice jazz bars, too.
Yeah.
A couple cool jazz bars. And, yeah, man. Good, it's a great party city.
I can't wait. So, what about Los Angeles? What are your dreams for the future here?
Well, I just want to, you know, I want to stick around here long term, so I just want to, just need to keep gigging, you know. I feel like I'm meeting people every day, you know, so I still feel like the new guy. It feels like you're going to be the new guy in this town for a couple of years, doesn't it? I don't know how you feel about it, but when you first move here, you feel new every night when you go out to clubs. So, I don't know, I want to find something that I can sink my teeth into, you know, whether it be an acting gig or another stand-up tour. And all we really want is to be busy, isn't it? Just out there working. And America is the one place that I've not worked in my career. You know, I've been everywhere, but I've never done a show in Chicago. You know, never done a show in Miami. I've never done a so that's my list now. You know, I've worked everywhere else in the world, but you know, I just did New York for the first time. I just did Detroit, and we played Boston. And so I'm seeing these cities for the first time. So even though I've been doing comedy a while, this is my new adventure. So that's what I'd like, is to start working around the country here and work towards being an American comedian, I think.
What do you like the most about the United States of America?
I missed the culture. I didn't realize how much I missed the culture. But I think when I moved to Britain in 98, I think I was rebelling against American culture. You know, I was rife to fall in love with Europe when I moved over in 98. And if anything, I probably had an attitude of like, you know, having left South Carolina, having left Marriott, I was probably like a little, fuck America, man. Fuck that shit. Fuck all the rules. Fuck all this crap, man. And then I found myself in Britain and they're like, oh, are you a taxpayer? Here's your free health care. You can drink in the streets and, you know, perfect place to be a 22-year-old party animal. So I fell in love with British culture, and that's what led me to stay there for so long. And now that I'm back here, I miss all these things that I didn't realize how much I miss them. So, you know, I'm a sports fan as well. It's nice to watch sports in a nice time zone. You know, there's nothing like having a sport on while you're doing some writing or something in the background. I love it. And in Britain, that can only happen at 2 in the morning. So I'm loving that, and I love the sunshine, and you know, and my family's happier, which is weird.
That you're in North America.
Yeah, yeah. My mom really likes that I'm back in North America, so she's over the moon, which is weird because I've tried to explain to her time and time again that if I left London, I could be at home in Nova Scotia for lunch. You know, if I left London in the morning, I could be home for lunch. You know, I'm closer. But she doesn't get it. She's still in her head. She thinks that L.A., at least I'm on the same continent. So she feels like she can get a hold of me right away.
You got to keep your mom happy, brother.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
JJ, I love you to death, brother. And it's always a joy to see you, my friend. Thanks for the Edinburgh advice.
Oh, no problem, man. I'm looking for, we'll have some more chats before you hit it up. It's going to be awesome. And I'm going to be over in Edinburgh as well. So
are you during the festival?
I'm going to come over on the 14th. So, great. And I'm going to do doing Late and Live.
Great.
So the notorious Gorilla Pit gig.
Yeah. In closing, do you have any words of advice or words of wisdom for the people of the earth?
Pull your heads out of your asses. That's sound advice for everybody.
That works.
Have a good heart and look at yourself and pull your head out of your ass.
That works. All right, brother. Long may you run.
Cheers, brother.